Hello and welcome to Mental Health Ireland's podcast, promoting positive mental health and well-being with our guests and you, our listeners. My name is Carmen from Mental Health Ireland, and on this episode we're talking to dietitian Orla Walsh. Orla is a member of the Irish Nutrition and Dietetic Institute and the Dublin Nutrition Centre. Welcome and thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on. I've been so excited.
So you're a new mum.
I am.
Have you noticed a difference in your relationship with food since you've become a mum?
Oh, absolutely. But I think it was beforehand because I knew I wanted to have a baby. It was, I knew from birth. I was always like dying to be a mum. But so to prep my body for pregnancy, I had to eat a certain way, just because of my own medical history. Just to, I suppose listeners might not want to hear it, but just to ovulate to make sure I could get pregnant. And then so nutrition helped with my fertility. And then when I was pregnant, well, firstly, I was sick as a dog for nearly the 9 months and for most of it, and I had insomnia. So nutrition became this great tool to help with the symptoms of pregnancy. And then, of course, you're growing a baby. So that's, you just want your baby to be produced from the best nutrition and, you know, you want them to have everything they need. Now, don't get me wrong, I wasn't over the top about it. It was the only time in my life I've had a sweet tooth, you know, so I don't know what it was about little crunchies, but they just hit the spot. But you know, that was so important. Then after he was born, you know, nutrition for me was in part of recovery. I had a C-section as well, so I had to recover from that physically. And then as the stages go on, nutrition became everything, because I'm sure a lot of women can relate, but there was a period where he was sick for a good while. So he had just a cold and croup and cold and cough and teeth and all this sort of stuff. And I got so down. It was the lowest time in my life. I've never really suffered now with mood issues before. Maybe once when I went to London, just because it was new, it was traumatizing in itself with all the things that went on. But for 4 to 6 weeks, I was so low. Only my husband knew. And it was nutrition that I went I focused on to help me feel better. And it was a great time because my son had started weaning. So together we were making sure we were eating as healthy as possible. And because he's weaning now and he's on soft, lumpy stuff, I'm eating the food he's eating. So it's really balanced, it's very varied, all homemade, and I can absolutely from my tips of my toes I can feel the difference. That dark cloud lifted. Now, you know, there was hormones, there's other things at play here. Nutrition might not be enough for everyone, but for me, the 4 to 6 weeks where I was just incredibly low, nutrition and exercise were the thing that helped that dark cloud lift. So yeah, nutrition has been absolutely central and my focal point through all of it.
So you talk a little bit about how your the relationship with your nutrition changed really from as soon as you got pregnant or before, when you were thinking about getting pregnant or hoping to get pregnant. So how soon can diet have an impact or an effect on our health? Like, for instance, can what a woman eats when she's pregnant have an impact on her child's health, her child's emotional health and mental health?
Oh, absolutely. So to answer the first question, if you start eating healthier, you'll notice the impact of that within an hour or two. It's that quick. So and we can see that from the other point of view. So if we just say are late getting our lunch, you know, we can feel our energy dip, you can feel your mood lower, you can feel kind of brain fog, you can feel hangry, you know, angry because you're hungry. So we know that. We also know that if you have, you know, just say you had a big pizza, like afterwards, or just say fish and chips afterwards, you don't feel like, you know, you could run a marathon. You don't feel light and energized from it. You feel sluggish afterwards.
So that we know that coma that people
food coma, exactly. We know that food can have that quick of an impact. In terms of nutrition, we do know, I think people focus on, when it comes to maternity, they focus on maybe weaning onwards, but actually it's from the moment of conception and nearly before that. So you need, for example, good stores of folic acid in your body, and you know, you need to be taking that folic acid supplement beforehand. During pregnancy, we're seeing nutrients are really coming to light in terms of how important they are for brain development in the baby. So there's things like iodine. Now, what we're worried about in Ireland is that around 50% of Irish women aren't getting enough iodine when pregnant. And this is going to worsen with the kind of anti-dairy nonsense movement that's going on at the moment, because dairy and fish are the two things that give us the bulk of our iodine. Dairy especially, because Irish people don't eat fish, which is such a shame. They certainly don't eat enough fish, shall we say. So we know that iodine during pregnancy is very important. We also know that other things like choline from eggs. So again, people are steering towards quite a strict plant-based diet at the moment, maybe excluding dairy produce. And we know that the iodine, for example, in the dairy, or the iodine from the fish, the choline from the eggs and the like, are so important for the brain development of the baby. Then we have studies that are really cool and showed that the mother's diet has a really big impact on the baby's behavior, you know, at different time points in their life. So we know, for example, what's interesting is that people think, oh, eating healthily will have an impact. But what studies and evidence is clearly showing with mental health, and even in terms of maternal mental health and maybe a toddler's health, mental health, is that eating lots of, I hate the term unhealthy, but just for easiness sakes to describe this, eating lots of unhealthy food has a negative impact, and eating a lot of healthy food has a positive impact. So there's these two things that are impacting it. So for example, if you stopped eating a lot of unhealthy food, that would have an impact. If you started eating healthy food, that would have another impact. So it's a double effect, not just a singular one. So we know that's important. And that's why in Ireland, we're trying to educate mothers and expectant mothers to really nourish themselves and look after their diet while pregnant. Apart from anything else, most pregnancies aren't planned and they're a bit of a surprise. So I think far more than people realize. And because so much brain development happens in the first few weeks when a woman doesn't know she's pregnant, that's why I would implore women to look at nourishing their body for pregnancy before it's even thought about or before it becomes a plan.
Okay. So you talk a little bit about educating women and educating ourselves on some of the maybe the myths around food or the misconceptions. So what are some of the other kind of common misconceptions about food and health?
There are so many misconceptions. I think one, if we look at mental health and kind of hone in on that, one of the ones is that when people think of disordered eating or having an eating disorder, people think that that person has to be emaciated, when actually lots of people who are underweight, a BMI within range or a BMI above range, have disordered eating or an eating disorder. So your body size doesn't reflect whether or not you're falling under that category. There's so many misconceptions. I think with food, if you look back historically, it was low fat, high carb diet, and that was, everyone had to follow that. And then all of a sudden it was low carb, high protein. And then all of a sudden it was high fat, low protein, low carb, the keto diet. And then all of a sudden now it's low animal protein and it's higher carb, it's higher fat. So the problem is, and the biggest misconception, that it has to be low or high anything. It doesn't, and it shouldn't be. It actually goes back to being actually moderate amounts of everything. So if someone wanted to make their diet healthier, what I'd encourage them to do is just go, okay, well, listening to that, if I need moderate amounts of anything, everything, what I'll focus on is eating as many different foods as I can in a day, and as many different plants as I can in a day. So it's about variety. If you get the variety there, your diet will become nutritionally more balanced. So for example, if you look at your breakfast, if, for example, at the moment you're having making a healthy choice and you're having porridge and it's just oats and you're making it on water, that's one food. So what I encourage people to do is go, okay, well, that's one food. It's just a carbohydrate source. I'm going to make my oats on milk. Now we have a carbohydrate source and milk is a protein source. Then you go a step further and go, okay, I'm going to add in a banana. So now we have a carb source, a protein source and a fruit or a veg. And then go, do you know what else would be lovely in that? Peanut butter. So we've got a carb source, a protein source, a fruit and a veg, a fat source. We've got four different things in the bowl now. And all of a sudden that bowl gives us a dip. Bigger variety of nutrients, and it's a much more balanced meal and it's a much more healthy meal. So just look at your meals and go, I need at least four different things here, and focus on having a carbohydrate, having a protein, having a fat source and having fruit or veg.
That porridge sounds delicious.
It does. Well, that's what I had this morning.
I'll have it tomorrow morning. So can what we put in our mouths affect our mental health, or how much does a poor diet feed into our mental health and our mental well-being?
So what, when you kind of dumb it down and you go, did you know that your head is connected to your body? And because I think people are very comfortable with the notion that what we eat affects our physical health. People are very comfortable with the notion that eating a healthy diet will reduce the risk of heart disease, will help reduce the risk of cancer, will help reduce the risk of diabetes. So it affects our physical self. What people are still coming around to the notion of, can a diet health affect our mental health? Of course it can. Our head is connected to our body. The food is feeding our brain. We know that our brain is where all the chemicals are that are responsible for mood and mental health, and you know they have an impact around our body, so it's a whole body effect. But diet feeds our body, it feeds our head, it feeds both of them, and therefore it feeds our mood. We know this, and we know the evidence is very clear, and it's becoming more and more clear as it's researched more and more. But eating healthy food will improve your mental health. Eating less healthy food will have a negative impact on your mental health. So if you give up eating, or not give up, reduce how much of the less healthy stuff you're eating, your mood will improve and your mental health will improve. If you add in healthy foods, again, on top of that, your mood will improve, your mental health will improve. So again, that two-pronged approach.
Okay. And so what foods are good for our mood? Like what are good foods for our mood? What's going to make us feel a bit better?
So firstly, I'm glad you said what foods are, because the problem in research and where a lot of the nutritional myths have come from is the fact that people have focused on nutrients far too much. We don't eat individual nutrients. So for example, people focused on saturated fat, and then they were like, why? We know saturated fat affects cholesterol, which affects heart disease risk. But why does saturated fat when we eat in food have a different impact on our cholesterol, which has a different impact on our heart disease? And it's because we don't eat single nutrients, we eat food. And within each food, there's this thing called a food matrix, where all the nutrients work together to produce a health benefit. So it's the sum of the parts is greater than the whole. I think I said that saying right. But
did.
It's basically all those nutrients together do wonders within the body. And certain foods certainly have been shown to be great for mental health. If we were to kind of make it easier for people to kind of go, okay, well, after listening to this recording, I'm going to go out and make some changes. What I focus on is a very Mediterranean style diet. That's where a lot of the evidence is for, because some of these individual foods that are so great for mood and mental health are within it and rich in it. So for example, oily fish, I think that's a well-known one at this stage. So oily fish, it tends to be a fish that isn't white. So it's a dark coloured fish, and it gives you this omega-3. That is omega-3 only found in oily fish or algae. It's not found in plants. So if you don't eat oily fish, I'd encourage you to try eating oily fish. Because the type of omega-3 within them is called DHA and EPA. And these sorts of nutrients are, we know that they're really important for brain health. So again, that's abundant in the Mediterranean diet. And I'd encourage people to maybe focus on having oily fish once a week, white fish once a week, and shellfish once a week, because they're nutritionally very different. And they're nutritionally offering you different minerals. So for example, white fish is very high in iodine. Shellfish can be very high in zinc. So you're getting getting different minerals and different nutrients when you actually break down fish into those three categories. Then I encourage people to don't fear fat, include nuts and seeds into your diet every single day. So even if it's just a handful of nuts, a snack, or you're adding the peanut butter to the porridge, or you're sprinkling some seeds on your salad, whatever it is, add those nuts or seeds in every single day. And also embrace olive oil. If you had an Italian person and if you had an Irish person putting olive oil on a salad, I just love it. Italians are so proud of their beautiful olive oil, tastes deadly, and they really believe in the health benefits. And we need to follow suit. We need to be, people are so stingy with olive oil. So just be a little bit more, loose-handed with it. So even maybe a tablespoon of olive oil on your salad, that sort of amount, it's really, really good for you. So don't fear fats. The other thing is, and it's not only good for our mental health, it's good for the environment, is to focus a little bit more on plant proteins. So beans, peas and lentils, they are absolute nutritional powerhouses. So many minerals in them, so high in fiber as well. And fiber is the thing that 80% of Irish people just aren't eating enough of. We aren't getting enough fiber. And the introduction of these can really up our fiber intake, up our mineral intake. And the great thing about these foods is that they tend to be more filling than any other food. The reason, one of the reasons for this is because they're high in a thing called soluble fiber. So it's a type of fiber that goes into our belly, forms a gel and slows the release of food into our intestines and into our body. Now this soluble fiber also reduces cholesterol and also softens their stool, which is really important for keeping our digestive digestion healthy. But this soluble fiber slows down the release of food from our stomach into our intestines and there into our bloodstream. That's really important for keeping our blood sugar levels stable. So when our blood sugar levels are leaping up and down, up and down, up and down, this can have a really big impact on our energy, which can have a big impact on our motivation and our motivation to, for example, exercise, which I know there's another recording about the importance of exercise and mental health. But what it can also do, that up and down with our blood sugars can have an impact on our energy, but also our mood. I think if you were to ask a type 1 diabetic, how do you know your blood sugars are high? Regularly enough, they would say, because I'm angry. So it does affect their mood quite greatly. And when their blood sugars are high, they know it because their mood changes, among other things. So we know keeping our blood sugar level stable is good for our energy and therefore our motivation, but also our mood. So that's what these plant proteins, these beans, peas and lentils do. They just stabilize our blood sugar levels. So the Mediterranean diet has really good sources of fat. So olive oil, oily fish, nuts and seeds. It's rich in these plant proteins, the beans, peas and lentils. But what it also focuses on is lots of fruit, lots of vegetables and lots of whole grains. Now, we know that when someone improves their intake of fruit and veg, their mental health improves. OK, so that's what the study, the evidence is suggesting. So again, it's to do with lots of things. Again, with the whole grains and the fruit and veg, it's to do with upping the fibre. But with the fruits and veg, it's to do with a lot of things. It can be to do with the vitamins they contain, especially the antioxidant vitamins, vitamin A and C. But it can also do to the fact that they're hydrating. You know, they're around 90% water. And we know that hydration is really important for our mood and our mental health. But it's probably to do with, again, what I talked about earlier about the food matrix within them. They're powerful when they're eaten as a whole. You know, you can't take a supplement and get, if you don't eat enough fruit and veg, a supplement won't cut it. It won't fill in the gap. That when you start eating more fruit and veg, you really will feel the difference. And when you look down at your plate, you'll notice that a much more colourful plate is much more inviting. And, you know, when you sit down and your plate is really colourful, you do smile. So I actually think it has an impact before it even gets into our body.
Does it have to be, does the fruit and vegetables have to be organic? Can it be like frozen fruit and veg? Like, do we need money to stay healthy and to have a healthy diet?
No. So I suppose the first question you asked me was, what was the biggest change since having a baby? And it's time. And I have, you know, the evidence on nutrition is very clear that frozen vegetables and frozen fruit are very nutritious. So we don't have to worry about them being fresh all the time. To be honest, there's around 1,000 things that can affect the nutrient content of fruit and veg. So I would encourage people not to focus on any one thing, like only eating organic or only eating X, Y, fresh, for example, or X, Y, and Z, I'd encourage people to focus on quantity first, because we know that Irish people are having maybe two portions of fruit and veg a day, which isn't nearly enough. So absolutely focus on fresh if you want. Sometimes it can taste nicer, but don't worry about frozen. Like that's been probably the biggest change for me in my diet at the moment, is that I rely heavily on it because I don't have the time always to peel and chop and all the rest, or even go to the shops as regularly as I want. So frozen is absolutely fine. What you said there was, is it more expensive? And there's this great study, and it's called the SMILE study. And what it showed was, they got people, and for 12 weeks, they got them to one group. They focused on more the social side of improving their mental health. The other group focused on their nutrition, and it was blinded. So the people obviously knew what change they were making, but the investigators didn't know which group everyone was in. And the one side of the group focused on, they saw a dietitian, so a registered dietitian, seven times on one-to-one, and improved their nutrition. And I think it was so surprising how much of an impact it had on people's mood. I think everyone was taken aback by the results, so much so that they're going, we need a bigger study. We need to see if we can replicate this, because around 30% of people went into remission. This is massive. It's huge. It's not me saying, listen, don't take medications and just follow diet. That's definitely not what I'm saying. But I'm saying this is a new study. It's too small to really change guidelines over, but it is a study that we need to make bigger and replicate, because the results were fascinating, and it really highlighted the importance of a healthy diet and the improvements in mood and mental health scores, specifically depression. But one thing that they honed in on, which I thought was fascinating, was the cost. Mm. And they found that eating a healthier diet was not more expensive. In fact, it was cheaper. And if you go and you think, okay, why might that be? But frozen veg, it tends to be cheaper than fresh. Canned fruit and veg tends to be cheaper as well. Canned beans, peas and lentils that I'm talking about, you know, not everyone's going to be steeping their beans, peas and lentils overnight in a bowl before they cook them. Those canned versions are much cheaper than just say meats are, or much cheaper than even fish or other animal proteins. So upping these plant proteins actually is a cost saver. So they found clearly in that study, not only did eating well improve people's mental health, but eating well was actually cheaper than their diets previously, which were much more rich in processed food.
Okay. So you've told us about the foods that are going to affect our mood positively, that are going to make us feel a bit better. What about the things that are going to make us feel not so good, or the things that might have a negative impact on our health and our well-being? Yeah.
So, firstly, the one thing I do want to make clear is there's no good or bad food. Okay. There's really, but you could say there is a good or bad diet, because one food in isolation isn't going to make a huge difference. So, take what I said when I was pregnant. I took my nutrition very seriously because I wanted to grow. I wanted to increase the risk of growing a healthy baby with no issues. But I still had my crunchy. And I just wanted to hone in on that. That one crunchy didn't mean my diet became terrible just because I had that single little crunchy in the evening time. Because your diet is, it's looking back in it and looking back in it as a, from a day to day or even week to week, how is there more healthy foods than less healthy foods in that diet? And that's what we mean by a healthy diet. So if you were to eat far too many processed foods, you know, where there's more processed foods than whole foods or natural foods, if you want to call it, that's when our mood will suffer. So we know that. So what I mean by processed foods is where it's highly processed. You know, lots of foods are processed to a point. So, for example, olive oil, it doesn't seep out of the olive oil tree that way. It has to be processed, but that's still a healthy food. It's still a nourishing food. What I mean by processed is when they take a food, they strip it of the fiber, they strip it off, you know, the outside of the grain, and a lot of the nutrients come with it. They add in salts, they add in sugars, or they add in fats. And these foods that are high in fat, salt and sugar and low in fiber are the foods that have a negative impact on our mental health when we consume too much of them. So I would encourage people to look at their foods and kind of go, like, even on a very basic level, instead of having apple juice in the morning, eat an apple. You know, instead of having a highly processed breakfast cereal, why not have something like, why not try porridge, or why not try whole grain bread with eggs or something like that instead? Instead of having chips in the evening, have a potato, you know. So it's just kind of looking at everything. So chicken nuggets, bring it to a chicken breast. And you don't have to do these changes overnight, but you will notice that as you gradually make changes, you'll gradually feel better for them. So I would look at each meal and start maybe every 3 days, even if you wanted to give yourself a name, or and that might not be doable for some people, and that's fine. And it might be not be enough for other people, and that's fine. They want to do more. But just even look every few days and go, OK, what other food can I change a processed food for, the more natural version or the more whole food version? And, you know, the whole food version tends to be foods of one ingredient. You know, you don't see ingredients on the side of eggs, and you're not there checking like what's added into eggs, because it's just one ingredient. It's just an egg. An apple is just an apple. Oats are just an oats, you know. Oily fish is, it's just salmon, you know. So there's nothing additional added in. So just go through your diet and in a very sustainable and slow process, start changing some of the processed foods to the whole foods. And like I said before, and I know I'm kind of going over this too much, when you start doing it, you'll get benefits from eating less processed food, and then you'll get benefits from eating more whole foods. So it'll be a two-pronged benefit, basically.
It sounds so beautifully simple and attainable.
I hope so.
But I know when I'm tired or I'm low, I'm not necessarily reaching for a bowl of broccoli. I'm reaching for a chocolate bar or a cup of coffee if I'm tired. So why do we reach for the bad foods or the comfort foods when we're feeling low or tired?
My favorite thing to say to my husband when he's really, my baby's the same, like, they're just hungry people and big people, and he would come in and be like, I'm starving, and I was like, there's broccoli in the fridge. Because if you're, like, if you're truly starving, you'd eat the broccoli. But he's not. He's, you know, he is hungry, but it is, like you said, he's low in energy, he's tired, and he wants something quick fix. So why do we do that? We do it for a lot of reasons. One of the reasons, our blood sugar levels might be getting low. So when our blood sugar levels go low, it's our lowering. It's our innate response, or response built into our body, to eat something that will bring our blood sugar levels back up again. You know, so type 1 diabetics find that, or people who suffer from hypoglycemia find that. So again, keeping your blood sugar level stable. So I often get people before, just say they leave work, to have a handful of nuts or something to stop themselves walking in the front door or walking home and being hungry when they arrive, because I think that would improve your food choice as that evening, but it would also help with relationships, because I think we're all a bit angrier when we're hungry. But that's one thing. The other thing is that food is comforting, and that's okay to say. I think there's this movement now that we can never see food as a treat, or we can never see food as a comfort blanket. And that's nonsense, because, you know, it is comforting. So if you said before we started recording, you're a bit cold, so you had tea. Mm. You probably didn't have the tea because you wanted the tea. You wanted that warmth. And you said, you know, maybe next time I'll have a herbal tea. But you were craving that warmth, that comfort from the hot mug. Mm. And that's okay. You know, it's okay as well to see food as a treat. Obviously, you don't want to see food only as a treat, or you don't want to see treats only as food, but it's okay that sometimes you go, oh, that was, you know, that was lovely. Like when I go out, like I, you know, when I have dessert in a restaurant, well, it's always a chocolate based one firstly, and I will only commit to it if it looks really good, because there's nothing more disappointing when you get a dessert, expensive dessert out, and it tastes horrendous. But it's okay to go, oh, that's delicious, this is lovely, and really feel like you're treating yourself and comforting and getting joy from it, because it's a natural brain response. We eat these foods, and one of the hormones responsible for, or one of the chemicals responsible for giving us that pleasure sensation, is dopamine. Dopamine is released when we think something is yummy. And, you know, the thing about food that people have to realize as well is that we eat with all five senses. And I'm weaning my kid at the moment and my mum's like, geez, you get him off, you let him get off messy. But the reason why I do is I want him to eat with all his senses. I want him to, like, it goes everywhere. He needs a bath afterwards, nearly. But I want him to feel the food, the texture. I want him, the food all over his face so he can smell it. I want him to taste it. I want him to see it. I want him to hear the crunch or hear the noise. So I want him to experience it with all his senses, because that's what we need to be doing every time we eat. We need to be using all our five senses so that we can get the maximum enjoyment from every time we eat. Now, is that realistically to do it all the time? No, because sometimes we have to eat in a rush, but it would be great if we started doing that more and more. This is part of the thing of mindful eating. So mindful eating is being present with as little distractions as possible and really sitting down and just tasting your food and making the most of it. One of my favorite studies was my favorite test to do to people. Have you ever heard the raisin test?
Oh, I think I have.
It's wonderful.
With the mindful eating.
It's so good. And it just gives you a whole new appreciation for raisins. But it's about getting someone to look at a raisin and look at both sides and go, gosh, they're different on both sides. Holding it up in the light and seeing the change. Then bring it towards their face and actually, at what stage do you smell the raisin? And then rubbing it against their lips so they can feel it, because we've loads of nerves around our lips. And to feel the texture, then putting it in their mouth, but not chewing. Just see how the taste changes as it stays in your mouth. Then swish it around with your tongue and maybe decide to take some bites. Take them slowly and see how the taste changes. And it's like the raisin, you can taste it, but all of a sudden you're biting it and you're eating it slowly. It's like it explodes with taste in your mouth. And this whole process, and then after you swallow it, stay there and to actually take note how long that taste takes to leave your mouth. And it's one of my favorite things to do because it brings in all the five senses to eating. It really teaches people mindfulness. But my favorite response and the most common response after I do the raisin example with people is they go, Janie Mac, I'm going to do this with a brownie.
So can you imagine?
Could you imagine? Like, if a raisin can give you that much joy.
Yeah, my mouth is watering just thinking about it.
Yeah, the chocolate brownie, you know, especially a sticky gooey one, maybe some ice cream on the side. Like, wow. Could you imagine the taste sensation? And I've done it with a brownie and it takes ages for the taste to leave your mouth. So all of a sudden when you do it with a brownie, instead of enjoying it for the 3 minutes, you could enjoy it for an hour. And like, to make a chocolate brownie eating scenario last an hour just sounds like heaven to me. Now at the moment I don't have that hour, but I will start dedicating more time to these wonderful life experiences.
Yeah, I'll never look at a raisin the same way again after that.
So I
did say that I'm in the cold weather, I am reaching for more tea, and it is more for the comfort. And I've talked a little bit about how I'm thinking about switching to herbal, because we're hearing more about the link between caffeine and anxiety. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Okay, so firstly, with coffee and tea, you'll see a lot in the media that coffee and tea are good for us. And obviously, this is a general statement because they're high in antioxidants. They're both good for us for different reasons. Coffee has even shown to reduce things like liver disease and has been actually associated with a lower risk of dying. Like, so coffee and tea are very good for us. The instance where coffee and tea might not be the best choice for people is, for example, if they have gut issues, the IBS, or a certain thing like anxiety. With anxiety, if you can imagine, caffeine makes everything happen in your brain just that little bit faster. We did this great study. Now, you won't believe me because it sounds so mad, but maybe they don't do these studies anymore in school. But I did physiology in Trinity, and we did the study where you had to drink water and do this computer test and see how fast you were. We had to drink a shed load of caffeine to see our reactions. And then we had two cans of beer to see our reactions. And the alcohol slowed her reaction time, the water had no reaction, and the caffeine, we were all like lightning. But if you think about someone being anxious, it's often people describe it as their thoughts and everything moving in their head so fast. And if caffeine is, it's like the oxygen to the flame. So it just makes those thought process. It just gives them more steam, so that it actually can make someone who has maybe mild anxious thoughts and just makes them go even faster around in their head and just make them into much more faster thoughts. So it kind of makes their anxiety speed up or worsen. So caffeine for someone who's anxious is one thing that I would encourage people. If you have anxiety, trial no caffeine. So trial reducing tea and coffee initially, and maybe fizzy drinks like Cokes and stuff like that. And maybe if you're that sensitive, chocolate even, and reduce your caffeine and see if it impacts your anxiety. And usually it does, because I think everyone feels that. Like during pregnancy, I couldn't drink caffeine, and then after he was born, all I needed was caffeine. So, but I became so sensitive to it. Mm. And I was surprised one day I had 2 cups and I couldn't sleep that night. Mm. And the thing about caffeine and coffee that people don't realize is that it has a half-life around 7 hours. So I had just say a coffee, my second coffee at 1 in the day. And 7 hours later, I was considering going to bed. But 7 hours later, it's still half in my system. So it's equivalent of me going to bed and drinking half a cup of coffee and wondering why I couldn't sleep. My thoughts were whizzing around my head at top speed. And it's amazing. Caffeine impacts your sleep for that reason, as well as its effect on the sleep hormone. But it really does. It can make people who don't have, just say they have anxious thoughts, but it makes people who have regular run-of-the-mill anxious thoughts and actually can and worsen that person's anxiety and giving them an episode where they actually experience anxiety, even to a moderate level. So I would encourage anyone who has anxiety to cut it out, maybe reduce it slowly or cut it out depending on their level of intake before they start, and just see, does it make a difference? And it nearly always does.
And there's always decaf as well. I find decaf can taste just as good.
Oh, listen. Yeah, that was my saving grace during pregnancy.
Yeah. So Orla, you are a dietitian by trade. That's what you do for a living. Who is your client base? Like, what is your client base, and have you seen a change over the years?
Oh, well, there's definitely been a change in the client base. Well, firstly, the collapse of the Celtic Tiger and the recession changed. So all of a sudden, you know, people are coming to see dietitians because they had to rather than they wanted to. So, for example, they had a condition or disease where it needed dietetic intervention and they had to go and see you. While when people have more money, they can come to you and go, you know, I don't want a condition or disease, or, you know, say they come to me because they want to improve their health, not because they have to come to me because they have to improve their health. So that's one thing. The other thing is probably I see a lot of people with disordered eating within the clinic, and what's been the scariest thing is the profile change in the teenagers. Mm. So just say around 7 years ago, shall we say 8 years ago, it was people maybe who had been diagnosed with anorexia nervosa, and they're going through their leaving cert, or they've gone into fifth year, they've come out of fourth year and they were going into fifth year or sixth year. And that was the bulk of the people that were coming in for with anorexia. And now it's younger and younger and younger. So what's probably the most common age now within my clinic is people transitioning from primary school into secondary school. So they're coming in and just being overwhelmed by that. And that is one of the triggers. So the age of people coming in with anorexia nervosa has gone from just say 16, 17 on average within my clinic to now being maybe 11 or 12 or 12 or 13, that sort of age. The other thing is that we're seeing a lot more boys now as well. I think we're seeing people with a diagnosis of anorexia very, very young. So you're talking about maybe even 8 or 9 years old. So that young, and we're of the really young children that are within the clinic. I think there's just as many boys as girls. So it is changing, and it's absolutely scary. And I think in part, you know, there's never going to be one cause for these things. But I think in some ways social media plays a role with the younger people. Now, this is again just what I'm experiencing from my own clinic, but in the younger people, they watch documentaries in school that were very anti-sugar. Or, and there were two different documentaries and the two different people I'm thinking of, but they were extremely anti-sugar. And like, if you're showing that to a child, they actually, and you're showing them a documentary on why sugar is poison. Now, obviously the documentary wasn't based on evidence because sugar isn't poison, but it, you know, I don't think that person, that that adult who was responsible for their care realized how much of an impact that could have on such a young mind. If it has an impact on old adults, you can only imagine that the impact on children would be greater. So I think the documentaries, the scaremongering documentaries not based on evidence that are out there are detrimental to children's health, and are helping. They're not the only cause, but they are one of the causes that the age for disordered eating within my clinic is reducing. And the other thing would be social media. So I for myself, I'm glad I didn't grow up in that era where everything was recorded, and you know, people are taking so many pictures of you on a night out like you're some sort of celebrity, and then you're going on Facebook or Instagram or Twitter or whatever it is and analysing them to the nth degree, or the pictures of you are being taken of you and being shared without your knowledge on the likes of Snapchat. You know, all of these things are just, they're so toxic. And then these platforms like Instagram now recently are banning celebrities pushing weight loss products. But, you know, that's, it's come too late. And what they're not controlling is people who aren't qualified giving advice. So I see dangerous nutritional advice on Instagram every single day. It's, you know, most of it's complete nonsense. And I see Irish celebrities, for example, one person is absolutely pushing vegan diets and they have a very young following. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's not a nutritionally complete diet. You need education before you start it, and you need to take supplements when you do implement it. And if you're pushing a vegan diet at teenagers, they, before they implement it, they won't have access to all that education that they need before implementing it. And they may not be taking the supplements. And they may even be doing it behind their parents' back, you know. It's so detrimental, especially in a growing body. Because I think far too often we're calling teenagers young adults. They're not young adults. They're not at all young adults. They are teenagers. They're growing children. And I think social media, it plays a huge part in disordered eating.
Speaking of the power of social media, there is a bit of a healthy food movement, as you say, healthy in inverted commas, on social media, especially with Instagram influencers posting healthy dishes and lifestyles. Is this overall having any sort of positive influence on us, or is it just far too much pressure?
I think it is in some ways. It's not all negative, certainly not. But the problem with Instagram, for instance, if someone's taking a picture of their meal, you don't know if that actually, firstly, you don't know if they ate it. You don't know what the other meals in the day look like. You don't know if they just took that picture off Google and posted it. A lot of the time the meal is nutritionally complete. It's just a load of fruit and veg put in a bowl. You know, I think there's, at the moment, from my opinion, is that there's much more negative than positive. The positive stuff is that when people are trying to make their meal more Instagrammable, they do add in more fruit and veg to make it more colourful, and that's healthy. I think there's a lot more healthcare professionals now on Instagram. So there's midwives, nurses, physios, dietitians, medical doctors, and I think people are following them more. So there's truth coming out. There's proper evidence being shared on Instagram now. And I think people are becoming more mindful of the fact that just because they look a certain way doesn't mean they know anything about nutrition or fitness. So I hope the tide is turning, but there's a lot of toxic stuff on social media, a lot. And there's also a huge element of fake stuff. Like I said, they could be a fake photo. Most of their followers could be fake. Most of their likes could be fake. You know, so there's not necessarily, it's not necessarily real. Mm-hmm. And it's certainly not a real world. And it, social media can't take the place of living in the real world. So, you know, it's not uncommon now to see people out to dinner and the two people out to dinner with each other and they're both on their phones. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, put down the phone. Eat your lovely meal, converse, live in the real world, don't live in the social media world. So I think at the moment it's still more toxic than positive.
Okay. We're hearing a lot about gut health.
Yeah.
And why gut health is so important. And it's kind of been named as like a second brain health. So why do we need to look after our gut and how can we do this?
So the way that we now see the brain and the gut, sorry, is nearly like the second brain. If you can imagine, you know, from your mouth, there's the food pipe and it goes down to your stomach. And then there's the wind pipe and goes down to your lungs. With our brain, there's the pipe, which is the from the brain, goes to, that's our spine. And then there's another route, which is our gut. So it's kind of like a similar Y junction. So we've known for a long time the spine is important for the brain. But I, you know, it's very obvious. But when it comes to the gut, what's becoming more and more obvious is the huge role the gut plays in mental health, but also physical health. Like we know that if, for example, the gut bacteria is so crucial. So the bacteria that's been living in our gut for so long is getting recognition for all it does for us. So for instance, you know, if you change the bacteria in our gut, it can have an impact on our kidneys. So we know that our gut bacteria and our gut health has an impact on nearly, it has an impact on every system in the body. So the brain-gut connection is the evidence for it is super strong and it's getting stronger and stronger. A lot of studies at the moment are still done on rodents. So for example, they took bacteria from a depressed rodent and put it into a rodent that wasn't depressed and it had an impact on their mood. So we know from rodent studies and animal studies that the gut bacteria is important when it comes to mood. But I think it's multifactorial when we look at gut health. So if your gut is malfunctioning, you can feel very fatigued from or tired from that. We can also, if your gut is malfunctioning, it can affect your quality of life in a big way. There was a study and it showed of all the conditions and diseases, how much of an impact it had on your quality of life. And IBS, so irritable bowel syndrome, was right up there. It was actually higher than asthma, which is difficulty breathing. So you can imagine how much of an impact it has on someone's quality of life. Everything from the clothes they wear to whether they're going out. You know, someone with IBS will always know where the nearest bathroom is. If they're constipated as well, it makes them feel sluggish. And it actually, when people pass that stool, they often admit to feeling or report feeling lighter, but also their mood lifts when they do. So we do know that IBS and your bowel malfunctioning has an impact on our mood and mental health, but also our mental health has an impact on our gut function. So if someone feels more anxious, they can experience more diarrhea and bloating and wind. The good news is that when it comes to diet can help in many ways. So diet, for example, can help with symptom management. So if someone's very anxious and it affects their gut, if you come in and help them relieve their symptoms of gut malfunction, it can help with their mood. Because it's which comes first, is it chicken or egg? Are you more anxious because your gut is malfunctioning? Is your gut malfunctioning because you're more anxious? So if you come in and help with symptom management, it often can help the anxiety. So that's one thing. The other thing that you can do is just promote good gut health. And how you promote good gut health with regards to diet would be things like making sure you're well hydrated, because if you're not drinking enough water, your gut movement slow down and it becomes very sluggish, and that actually has a physical effect on people where they feel very sluggish. So hydration is important. Fiber is important. So like I said earlier, 80% of Irish people don't eat enough fiber. Now, when you improve fiber, it improves gut function. But the key is to increase your fiber slowly, so that allows time for your gut to get used to those increases. But when you're looking at increasing your fiber intake, don't just, for example, take a fiber supplement that will do that. Because there's a couple of benefits that fiber will give that a supplement won't. One is that it comes from a food, and the individual foods have benefits for our gut as well. The other thing is a food will often give lots of different types of fibers, and it's the different types of fibers helps our gut in different ways. The other thing is that there's non-digestible parts within certain foods, and they go down to our gut bacteria and they feed our gut bacteria. So our gut bacteria feed and flourish with these foods. And what the gut bacteria also do is they then take that energy and feed the walls of our gut, helping our gut stay healthy. And whatever's left over, but they also supply some of that energy to us, to our body as well. The most important thing to create a good microbiome in your gut is not necessarily taking probiotics or not necessarily taking fermented foods, although they have been shown to help, but it's simply getting a varied diet and eating as many different plants as possible. So most people, if I was to hazard a guess, most people eat less than 8 plants a day. That's certainly what I've seen within my own clinic when I did a mini audit, as nerdy as that sounds. But what I encourage people is to really focus on increasing the number of plants they eat every single day. So how you might do that is, so just say at breakfast you have Weetabix, and then at lunch you have bread, and then at dinner you have pasta. That's wheat. So it's kind of going, okay, well, maybe I'll have Oatabix, maybe I'll continue with the sandwich, but maybe I'll have rice at dinner. All of a sudden that's oat, wheat, and rice. So it's 3 different grains, 3 different plants. Instead of only, you know, often people come in and they only eat peanut butter or they only eat cashews, for example. Again, it's kind of going, okay, well, why not one day have Brazil nuts, another almond, another sunflower seeds, another sesame seeds, another pumpkin seeds, and increase the amount of different nuts and seeds. Again, increasing the difference in plants. With fruits and veg, if you eat 3 different fruits one day and 3 different the next, or every few days, eat different fruits, you're going to be increasing the amount of plants. Same with veg. So I'd encourage people to look at how many plants they're eating and increase it. And a good aim that I tend to give people, because people tend to like numbers to aim towards, is to eat 30 different plants a day. So
that seems like a lot.
Sorry, a week.
Sorry,
a day. 30 different plants a week. And it just makes them think. It makes you step back and go, oh, you know, I only tend to cook with onions and peppers. Maybe I'm going to buy carrots and parsnips this week. You know, it's really, it makes people step outside their standard shopping list and go, okay, well, what else might I add to it? So 30 different plants a week. So okay. Take note.
Orla, finally, just to ask yourself, when times are tough, who or what is your go-to?
When times are tough, well, who I go to is my husband, definitely. Marrying him was the best decision of my life. So I'm lucky to have him. And what we do is we just keep the lines of communication always open. So during that 4 to 6 weeks, as soon as my mood went low, I told him. I wasn't waiting to see if it stayed low. I wasn't waiting to see if it picked up later in that day. I just told him. And I think communicating and actually expressing what you're feeling inside rather than keeping it trapped inside was one of the most positive things I could have done. Because when it's inside, I feel like it's nearly fermenting within me. So I think talking, having a person that you can go through. And I think in every aspect of our life, I wouldn't talk to him about woman's troubles. Like he wouldn't know, you know. So for example, I'd have friends that I would go to about different things. So some of my friends are very pragmatic and I go to them about certain problems. My family are wonderful. I go to my sister about something. I go to my mom about something. So have people for different instances. You don't just have to have one go-to person as well. But what I always think is that if I'm in a bad mood, if I go for a walk, I come back in less of a bad mood. if I'm still in a bad mood, I go for another walk. I think the power of being outside, I think we focus too much of exercising in gyms or indoors, and the power of exercising outside, it's not underestimated. Like when you come home from work, often you feel tired, you feel sluggish, you've been inside all day. If you go out for a walk, you're in the great outdoors. There's no ceiling above you. So I always feel that that negative energy, it's not getting trapped in the room with you. It just dissipates. Nature is so beautiful, and it's I just think when you walk as well, your blood's flowing, you've time to think and get your thoughts in order. You come back and your energy's better. And when your energy's better, your motivation to do more exercise or to eat well or it is better. And it also, it helps with sleep too. So I think for me, my go-to is walking and walking outdoors. But I will always, because I'm a dietitian and because I've seen the evidence and because I know the evidence and I believe in it, I will always come back, and my focal in everything I do will always be food. And so when times are tough, I will take each meal as it comes. And I, during that 4 to 6 weeks where I was feeling very low, what I did is I just said, okay, breakfast, I just kept it simple. Breakfast is going to be porridge and it's going to make in milk, and I'm going to put something tasty in it like cinnamon or mixed spice or ginger, whatever it was each day that went with the fruit and nuts or seeds that I had within it. Lunch was always a soup and a sandwich, because there's something comforting about the warm soup, and the sandwich is nice and balanced when you have veggies in it and you have protein. And dinner, I kept it very simple because I didn't have the motivation to do anything that involved too much work, and it just potato, meat or fish and veg. And I just kept it simple, I kept it colourful, I kept it balanced, and I kept going with that simple thing, knowing that if I ate balanced meals at breakfast, lunch, dinner, if my hydration was good, if I reduced my caffeine and try to increase my sleep, and if I walked a little bit more and was outdoors without earphones in, without ringing anyone, just me with my thoughts and my baby pushing that stroller outside, that I would start feeling better. And I did. And it's my go-to during that time, and it was my go-through in every tough time I've had or every challenging time. And it will, that sort of solid, solid changes will always be my go-to, because that will never not work even a little bit. I'm not saying that it's going to solve everyone's mental ill health during a period, but it will always, always help. One thing that's important though is to note that I was able to make those changes at the time. So sometimes people are, they're mentally unwell, and that even the smallest of changes can feel like a mountain. So often I get people to pare it back and go, okay, realistically, what is something that you could do? And it might just be, you know, sometimes going for a walk can seem like a big mountain for someone to climb. I said, okay, don't go for a walk. All I want you to do is put on your runners, go out through the front door and close the door behind you. All I want you to do. Some of the time, they'll go for a little bit of a walk. Sometimes they'll go for a long walk. Sometimes they'll come back in. But it's just to break it down into those small steps. Put on the runners, go outside, close the front door. And don't, I think goal setting can be good, but when you're suffering and going through a hard time, I think intentions are sometimes even better, because you don't need added pressure. So I would get people to break it down that little bit. Or when it comes to their diet, go, okay, add a fruit or a vegetable to every single meal. You know, and just keep it at something that's really doable, that you can achieve, and that all of these things will make a difference. They will, they'll bring you forward. Healthy steps will always bring you in a healthy direction.
Orla, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a pleasure and a real education. I learned a lot.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you.